seen anything like that.
I'm a very confident front runner for Caddy for 33 years, 145 wins now, and that's the best win I've ever had.
I have no idea what you have.
I don't know. How are we going to count all the shots? I can't keep track.
Fuck! God damn it!
I don't think he's pleased.
Of course you would. That's a particularly stupid question. It's the Irish Open. Of course you want to play at the weekend.
And you're very welcome to Golf Weekly. It's been an extraordinarily good week for Nelly Korda. It was a very, very good week for Riviera Golf Club and for the LPGA in general. It was also a superb week for JD Poston. It wasn't a bad week for Ryan Gerrard. A very good week for Tyrrell Hatton. A bit of a meh week for Rory and a not great week for Scottie Scheffler. There's the headlines. The gang is back together. Gary, Dave, how are you, lads?
Hey, boys.
Hello, boys. I'm very well.
Weekend of golf.
Huh?
What a weekend of golf.
Wasn't it just?
Arguably the best weekend of the golfing season so far, certainly outside of the majors.
And for me, the US Women's Open at Riviera was the best event of the year outside of the majors. Sorry, outside of the men's majors for me, by a mile.
Yeah, it was amazing. It was everything. We'd obviously previewed it last week, and I think it lived up to any expectations. We probably exceeded them, I beg your pardon, and the drama at the end and just the way that...
That putt.
Oh, God. Even if our listeners and viewers have not seen a single shot from the final round at Riviera, just watch the final putt.
Yeah.
It'll give you all sorts of emotions, from relief to the heebie-jeebies to fear to it's so relatable to ecstasy. It's, oh my God, all those emotions fly through your being in what, the 2 seconds it takes for the ball to roll off the putter face to the bottom of the court.
It went. Sorry, Gary, go on.
I think the lesson on it is, unless you're literally on the side of a hill, anything inside 2 feet is a straight putt with pace.
Yeah, fair enough.
She was trying to look for a bit of break, and I don't know how. I still don't know how the ball went in the hole.
It was incredible.
I'm so happy it went in the hole.
Yeah. So just to recap, so you had Nelly Korda leading by one, going up 18. She put it to what, 38 feet, and needed 2 putts for par to win. Left the first putt, just uncomfortably long, and then it kind of horseshoed around the putt, like it did like a 10-inch horseshoe before finally dropping in.
I think she was so lucky she tried to dribble it in the hole. If there was any pace on that, it was gone.
Yeah, it would have gone out.
And imagine, I can't remember who it was in, as Dave would call it, the LA Open, but a couple of years ago, someone had a putt to win, a short putt, and they missed it. The other side of the hole, on the right side, putting across the green, they missed it high from about 4 feet, or a putt for a playoff or something, and it horseshoed like 6 feet. So it is cut on a bit of a slope there, but I was delighted it fell. It would have been, you just don't like to see that. I don't care if it's, well, maybe England to win the World Cup, but that'd be about it, really.
Yeah. So you had the world number one, Nelly Korda, arrives as the dominant player in women's golf, but who had repeatedly fallen short in the US Women's Open, a tournament she talked about wanting to win since the age of 14 and widely regarded as the championship, you know, the game's toughest and most prestigious one, certainly for the LPGA Tour. I thought there was echoes of Rory McIlroy's Masters triumph from last year about it. It was like the best player, or certainly the dominant player in the game, finally conquering, you know, climbing the mountain that they have wanted to climb for a very long time. And lads, I don't know about you, but what made it all the more compelling for me was that it's not as if Nelly arrived with her best stuff. I mean, I think she was confused by not having her best stuff, but she didn't dominate the course. She didn't overpower it. She had an early stumble, recovered. She stayed very, very patient. And when you consider the only birdie she had on Sunday was on 17, but it proved to be the decisive birdie. So this was a tournament win that rewarded patience, control, just staying one shot at a time, and just being able to get over the finishing line while not necessarily having her best stuff.
I think she kind of showed her class too, because, you know, there was a good chase in pack, and Charlie Hull is very exciting when she's in that role, because she undoubtedly has a bit of an X factor, and she putted. I know she missed a couple of, well, one shortish one and then another shortish, but she literally putted lights out over the weekend. And you'd love to see her win a British Open, maybe, because you can see what, you know, what the US Open means to the Americans. And I think that might be Scotty Scheffler's issue at Shinnecock too. And the fact that he sat on a Grand Slam. So for Korda to have that much poise, it was great. But I do, and we'll probably get onto it later on, but I watched the Live Golf on Sunday too.
That was terrific. At Valderrama.
Yeah, but I think the big point and the reason, you know, the Chevron is absolute muck and no one wants to go to it or wants to watch it. Like, the venue is such a key factor, because I remember 100 years ago I was playing in the Donnell Links in St. Andrews, and I was struggling a bit with my game at the time, and I employed one of the many head shrinkers that I had in the course of my search for greatness. And he made a fascinating point to me, which is kind of probably what Nelly was feeling, except she actually won the bloody thing. You know, you are walking in the footsteps of giants, and people, whoever has been there and done it, has kind of done it around there. It's unusual that Jack and Tiger haven't, but and she's a bit of a connoisseur of the sport too. So all of that would have added to the enormity of her walk around the back nine. And it seemed like she, you know, there's no denying she was unbelievably nervous, but she seemed to embrace it and find a bit of patience with the two. But I think the venue adds so much to these tournaments. It really does. And even, you know, I'm not a big fan of Liv, but the events I've watched on Liv where I've known the course and I've seen and maybe played in a few tournaments around them, you know, Valderrama is an iconic golf course in Europe, and you know exactly what's facing them all coming down the stretch, as we did with Korda at Riviera. So I think the venue is crucial for the total package.
Well, we might as well talk about the venue now, because I do want to talk about Charlie Hull, and I totally agree with you, Gary. She's a genuinely exciting contender. Now, this is five runner-ups in majors, so, you know, she's forever the bridesmaid maybe at the moment, but like you, I hope that she wins. But let's talk a bit about Riviera. So, so again, to Gary's point, the venue elevates the tournament. Riviera is so familiar to us. But Dave, the thing that really I found so interesting was is that because the women, even the prodigious lengths that the likes of Anelli Korda hit it, they're not hitting like massive bombs. They're not obliterating courses the way the men do. So all of a sudden, Riviera showed all of its brilliance.
Yeah, well, we got to watch Riviera. It was like getting into a time machine and watching Riviera. The way it was designed to be played, the way it played when Faldo was winning there in the mid-90s. You know, longer irons into greens and seeing parts of the golf course that you might never see because lads are bludgeoning the ball 330 yards. And obviously, it always looked easy on the eye, the architecture, the buildings around the clubhouse, that view heading up the 18th fairway. And so we got what we expected in that regard. And then it was a difficult golf course for the players to really play. Like, 8 under par is a really good score for a US Open. And obviously there were birdies out there. Nobody proved that more so than Charlie Hull, who actually outscored Nelly Korda by 4 shots over the weekend. I mean, that's just an incredible performance from her. It was her second round really that did her. But going back to Nelly Korda, like we say it so often, so many majors are won by who can just hang around the longest.
That's it.
And I don't know how to put a number on it, but of the 15 majors that Tiger Woods won, half of them must have been won because he was able to hang around longer than anybody else. Case in point, his last major at Augusta in 2019, when he just hit the right shots at the right time and everybody else just fell apart around, mainly around the 12th green. But her ability to turn up, I think this would be her that putt will be the defining moment of her career for a number of reasons. A, because as you say, it's not quite McIlroy territory. She didn't have to wait 11 years for her next mate.
No.
But it's and it wasn't for a Grand Slam, but it was for the tournament that she coveted the most, yeah, and the one that she was struggling the most to win. So that'll always be her maiden US Open, and obviously one that she will cherish and keeps the calendar Grand Slam potential alive for. It also was her winning a major when she hadn't really brought her best stuff.
That's it.
Must be so fulfilling for her, particularly when someone like Charlie Hull, who was a real swashbuckling charismatic player, when she gets it going, or particularly when she gets the putter going, she's hunting her down. And she wasn't spooked by the fact that she wasn't holing any putts and that she was only kind of tipping along the golf course, making par after par after par. She knew her chance would come, and it did on the par 5 17th. The par 5s which she played, I think she finished 8 under par for the tournament. I think she played the par 5s and 8 under par.
Yeah.
So that's where she won the tournament, yeah, obviously. And her ability to get up and down. Look, obviously, to win a major championship, you have to have a good short game. She missed 15 greens over the weekend, and she only failed to get up and down once.
Yeah,
you've got that in your locker. Everything is possible. And that's the reason you can win when your A game isn't there. It's the reason why McIlroy won at Augusta this year and won at Augusta last year, when he wasn't really playing what we know is his absolute best game, because he was able to get up and down from difficult spots. And that takes an awful lot of spine, an awful lot of guts, so much talent and composure. She was not the best player in the field at the weekend, but her expertise, her experience, her composure, her resilience, her stubbornness, and that unbelievable short game is why she won by a single shot.
Yeah. Gary, it felt, again, about Riviera, the course tested. It didn't rely on like gimmicks, excessive punishment. It just tested every facet of the game. So you needed to drive the ball well. You needed approach play. But the scrambling, and Dave talked about Nelly's extraordinary scrambling over the weekend. You needed to putt. You make putts. You needed to make putts. Charlie Hull made a bucket of them. But you had firm greens, like interesting strategic angles, I thought, and the green complexes, look, they're difficult. They're not easy greens to put on. But to me, it just made one, this is a venue fully deserving of championship golf, and it delivered all of that and more. And look, I mean, I realize that we're in the business of, and I want to ask you about this in a second, but like, we're in the business of entertainment, and it delivered the champion that most neutral fans really wanted.
I think it did. I think Nelly Korda to the LPGA Tour is a bit like Rory McIlroy when he comes back to play in the DP World Tour. She's,
yeah,
you know, she in a, you know, in an era where a lot of the Asian players are phenomenal, but they're devoid of charisma. So it's a hard.
I mean, in fairness to them, it could be a language issue, a language barrier. They maybe aren't comfortable expressing their true selves in English, and you know, maybe the Koreans
absolutely
are hilarious, and we just don't know, yeah, because
one of my favorite things to watch on TV is I love watching Korean stuff on Netflix.
My mother's watched everything that's ever been made on Korean.
I'm a big fan of watching subtitles. I think it gets you off your phone. You actually have to concentrate and watch something for a couple of hours. But and I spent a lot of time early in my career playing in Asia, and it's a totally different dynamic and philosophy that they bring to the sport. You know, they're not, you know, and it's a basic education thing when they start out. They're basically told to play the game, most of them, without any emotion. And that's probably the right way to do it. And perhaps that's why they're so good at it. But from a commercial point of view, that's a tough sell. Now, the girls don't care, and most of the guys don't care either, because they're achieving what they want in their careers. Yeah. But for the sake of commerciality, you need a poster boy, you need a poster girl. And she's undoubtedly, you know, vital to that tour. And then to win your national open in the fashion that she did. Mm. You know, it kind of rings true for everything they're trying to sell for the tour.
And also as well, it adds that in order, if you're going to be the dominant player, you need to have an antagonist, or you need to have a challenger. And look, 5 second places in major championship shows that Charlie Hull is not a fly by night. She's there for the duration. She's a top player. She couldn't be more different to Nelly temperamentally.
Yeah.
And I think that's like, look, even the way it played out in the final round, Charlie Hull attacked. I mean, she did start. Did she start Eagle Birdie? Like, I mean, whereas Nelly Korda minimized her mistakes, but Charlie Hull just was like going for everything. And it made for such an exciting watch, I thought. And Charlie Hull, I'll repeat myself, but Charlie Hull to me is just such an exciting presence in golf.
It is. I think the only thing that was missing was, had they been playing together, would have been, it would have been awesome, because you have the kind of boisterous, let's go for it, and Nelly is just plotting her way around, totally in control. So it would have been like, I don't know, back in the day, Goosen against Ernie Els type of thing, you know.
Could be. It's Woods against Mickelson. That's what it is.
Woods and Mickelson, yeah. So, yeah. And she can only, you know, Charlie Hull can only take a lot from this. I think, you know, it's amazing. She's going to be in Ireland playing in the Women's Irish Open in August on the South Course of the K Club. So, and I've never seen her
nice plug.
Play live. Yep. The only ladies event I covered was in Galgorm, and she didn't play. But I did get to see Lynn Grant play that week, and she's certainly one to look out for too.
She's terrific.
She won that men's event, that dual event in Sweden. So,
Dave, about Charlie Hull, again, again, it's those narratives that are important in sport. Is you need to have the A type versus the B type, you know. And look, we know what Nelly Korda is. You know, she's control, she's patience, she's precision. She's just the most beautiful swing that doesn't seem to have any flaw in it. Charlie Hull is flair, risk, unpredictability. So some weeks she's going to shoot the lights out. Other weeks she's going to stink the joint out. But that's just the way she plays. Her character seems a reflection of that. You know, I don't know if she's still smoking, but I kind of like that about her. Not. Oh, she not? She's quit, has she?
It's cardigan versus cravat, really, isn't it?
It is a bit. Also, did you hear in one of the pressers the story she was telling about Malibu, that she was disappointed with Malibu because she thought, I just see Jennifer Aniston just walk around the street, and I was really, fucking hell, didn't see it. Nah, she wasn't there. I know. And I kind of love that. I actually love it. I think she's brilliant.
Yeah, she's great to watch. She's just a completely different character. Like, and I would know someone like Nelly Korda, she wouldn't necessarily draw me to her in terms of watching her as a golfer. Certainly if she was a man, I wouldn't be, because I've watching her with a huge amount of excitement, because I just think there's so many golfers like that are out on tour at the moment. But her swing is just so unbelievably good. And you know how much steel she plays with, which kind of makes her alluring in some ways. Whereas, as you say, Hull is the other way. Like, she plays with a smile on her face. She's very like Tyrrell Hatton. You know, she can fly off the handle, and she can also like put out this beaming smile. Like, the way she reacted when she held that putt in 18 was great. What a putt that was as well, because that was essentially for the championship in her mind, because at the time she knew that Charlie Hull or that Nelly Korda still had to play 18, which is a difficult golf hole. And
had she made the birdie on 17 when Hull made the putt? Because
I'm not sure, but even if at that point, if Nelly Korda had been on 8 under par, Charlie Hull knew she had to hold her putt to stay on 7 under at 4. Nelly Korda to make a 4 on the last. So, like, it was at the very least, she would have been thinking, this is a putt for a playoff.
Yeah.
Potentially it is for, you know, my first ever major title. And she drained it. Like, it looked like she was under no pressure at all. So you'd love to see her in a position where she can actually be standing over a putt that is to actually win a major tournament. And look, she's going to be obviously a contender going into the last couple of majors of the season at the Evian and the Open Championship and the PGA Championship, which is coming down the tracks very soon. See, but I think what you're kind of hinting at, Fionn, what we would like to see is, and it's something we haven't seen yet with Scheffler and McIlroy, is the two of them going at it in the same group on the back nine of a major championship Sunday. That's what we haven't got yet. And I'd love to see how that would play out if Hull is staring down Nelly Korda.
I want Hagler Hearns. I want Chicago Bulls, LA Lakers. I want Man City, Liverpool. I mean, and that's, and it seems to me that, like, look, Nelly Korda, you know, I don't think I'm staking my reputation here by saying Nelly Korda to me is the superior golfer overall. I mean, she's generationally talented, and she might win more majors. But I think fans I think would gravitate more towards a Charlie Hull because she's so much more relatable and she gives of herself in a way that Nelly Korda doesn't. And Nelly Korda doesn't have to. This is in no way a criticism of Nelly Korda or the way she, but I would agree with you, Dave. I think that like ultimately as a fan, there's something about Charlie Hull that's so immediately attractive in a way that in the day fans gravitated towards Phil Mickelson and they loved him, Phil the Thrill. But they admired the hell out of Tiger Woods because Tiger Woods was the greatest of all time.
Yeah, there really are very similar parallels. And look, if you want to go back to, I compared Hull to Hatton, Korda is more Scheffler-like, isn't she? She's absolutely brilliant. She hits these unbelievable iron shots. She always seems to be in control of her game. Well, though, we're going to get on to Scheffler in a few minutes.
And Fionn, because there's always learning watching these things, she only tries to draw the ball. She never tries to fade the ball.
Nelly?
Yeah, so yeah. She's very... No, I wouldn't say Tom Lehman, because Tom Lehman couldn't cut up his dinner, but Tom Lehman was predominantly a right-to-left player, and he did it, and he got to world number one, and he won his Open Championship. So it's a lesson for everyone. If you can't do one side of the game, there's nothing wrong with being one-dimensional in golf.
No, absolutely not. And I think it's interesting, there was like a mini drama even within the Nelly Korda camp, because I think it was on Friday evening after her round on the range, she wasn't finding that little baby draw that has been her stock and trade virtually all of her career. And it was her sister. She was gripping and re-gripping and, you know, constantly couldn't find her grip. And it was her sister was like, Nelly, stop. Stop trying to find a new grip. And I think Nelly made the joke afterwards. You shouldn't really change your grip mid-tournament. It doesn't really work.
Maybe not, no.
No, probably not. One of you has mentioned earlier on, and I think it's a very, very good point about that about Riviera and how the LPGA Tour, which is always in a fight for relevance, audience, and I won't say survival, but certainly to thrive. It's such a brilliant decision by the LPGA to pick venues that are recognizable to the wider golfing public. So Riviera, but then you've got coming up, you've got Inverness, Oakmont, Pinehurst are on the road. So to what extent do you think that playing at these iconic courses with these wonderful, recognizable configurations is going to be a massive help to audience watching events on the LPGA Tour?
I think it's crucial to the overall product.
Yeah.
You know, and there's so many venues in the States, they're spoiled. Ideally, with certain majors, you'd like to find new venues. And, you know, the question has to come is, you know, when is the Masters going to be on the list for the women pros? You know, when is the Green Jacket going to go the other side too? Because I think they've slowly done it with the juniors, with the amateurs. So I can't imagine it's that far away. I think the women's introduction.
Is that being discussed at all, Gary? You're literally the first person who I've ever heard bring that up.
Yeah, because, well, why shouldn't... Now, I know they have five...
I'm just questioning, like...
Yeah, I know they have five majors, but why not, really? If the four that the lads have are so iconic. You know, I think the Chevron is... It's a struggle, really.
The change of venue,
it's a bit of a meh. So why not bin that and have it at Augusta National?
So you can have... I suppose it's assuming that Augusta and their attitudes move from the 19th century directly to the 21st, bypassing the 20th century altogether.
It is. I think it's a conversation worth having, really. If you're going to do it properly. I think, you know, Evian is... It is what it is, but is it really a full major? It's a Mickey Mouse golf course in the middle of the hills type of thing. I'll get shot down for that. But I think, you know, if you're going to try make the argument for a little bit of parity, why not just do the same thing?
Well, they're certainly getting parity. Well, not parity, but we talked last week about the money that was involved, and the winner's check is absolutely enormous. But like when you mentioned the golf courses that they've already penciled in for future US Opens, Sean, you've mentioned Oakmont, Pinehurst, Inverness is next year. They're back at Riviera in just 6 years' time. Yeah. Merion, where Rose won his US Open in 2013. That's in 2034. Pebble Beach, 2035. Shinnecock Hills, the venue of the men's US Open next week. That's in 2036. They're just unbelievable.
Yeah, venues. It's I mean, it's clearly a play by the LPGA, and I think it's a really, really smart one. I think what it does is it gives relevance, meaning, importance, everything to what should be. I mean, but I agree with you, Gary. I think that, look, you have five majors, which always feels a bit odd, but to make sure that the other four are also given equal import, or certainly they're given a status that perhaps, you know, the Chevron doesn't have really. I'd agree with you with Evian. Maybe I wouldn't go so far as you did, but yeah, I think like in this sense, the course can make the tournament, and yeah, I don't see why that's
well,
not
just look at. I guarantee Dave probably enjoyed watching Live at the weekend because it was in Valderrama. The venue is.
Nah, didn't watch any of it.
You didn't watch it. Of course you didn't. That's why you and I are going to discuss that.
How much time do you think I have, Gary, that I can sit around watching, you know, Live Golf, then tune in, spend the evening watching the US Open, watching Memorial? Come on, man.
I thought you'd be on 9 o'clock Thursday morning watching Live.
Memorial. Now there's, I mean, obviously Jack's Place. The Memorial Tournament in Dublin, Ohio. I mean, there's an iconic golf course. I'm going to say the 18th at Killeen Castle is very, very reminiscent of the 18th at the Memorial Tournament.
Clubbing last night, is that why you're wearing that top? Are you still feeling the effects of, you think the 18th at Killeen Castle is anything like the 18th at Muirfield Village?
Do you not like my... For anyone,
it's a drive and a wedge film.
Yeah,
to a shocking grin.
Not for me.
Well, it's a drive and a six and iron. A pitch and run for Rory McIlroy. If it's a drive and a wedge for me,
oh sure, I know. Look, yeah, but play it off the tip. I mean, actually, no,
there you go.
Okay, the tips aren't anyway. But the point being, the shape of it, the way it looks as it comes up towards at Muirfield, it's the clubhouse in Killeen. It's a castle. Anyway, that's not the point I was going to make. JD Poston, very nice playoff victory over Ryan Gerrard. I thought it was a very good finish to, I mean, I'm not going to say a disappointing tournament. Disappointing only is that my pick of Ben Griffin didn't even make it to the weekend. And I think our collective pick of Scotty Scheffler, we'll talk about him in a second, he let his frustrations out the bag. But look, he birdied three of the final five, including the last one. And then, what is it, Ryan Gerrard three-putted the second playoff hole to lose. But like, yeah, I mean, I have to say, it was a good finish for Poston, deserved winner. I feel a little bit for Ryan Gerrard, but I also think, you know what, Ryan Gerrard is a very good example of the tour model that the PGA has adopted. So like a guy who's played his way into signature events and then performs. And so, you know, it's not been a bad week for Ryan Gerrard, but it's been an even better one for JD Poston.
And he came back from the dead, really, didn't he? Like, yeah. He had that horrible stretch of holes between 9 and 13 where he played them in three over par. And that's why he had to make those birdies in 14 and 15. And he had to drain a putt on pretty much every green that he walked on from the 14th in, including obviously that putt that he held on 18.
Yeah.
Had to hold a big par putt on 17 and then played the playoff hole really impressively. So I'd say he was struggling, JD Poston, with the enormity of what was unfolding for him over the course of the first few holes, because he took a lead into the last day. It was a kind of a stop-start final day with weather issues. And I'd say having to go out and win a signature event, which is clearly the biggest win in his career. It's his fourth PGA Tour win, but it's comfortably the biggest tournament that he's ever won. Having that growing on and gnawing at him over the course of a long day maybe started to get on top of him. And then he may well have been freed up by the fact that suddenly he had slid down the leaderboard. And Tommy Fleetwood was playing the best golf of the players in contention at the time. He was holding putts, got himself into the lead, and JT Poston had to come from behind and go and kind of take this by playing the last five holes in three under par, which is really impressive around that golf course.
Gary, he arrived or the week before, he was outside the top 100 in strokes gained putting, changed his putter, and he's, well, not quite, I don't think he was number one, but certainly he was in the top of the putting stats. Is that a reflection of the actual putter or just a change of a mindset, or psychologically he just decides this suits my eye, this suits my feel? Like, I'm sure he didn't change his putting style.
No, he's a renowned putter. I think it was Seamus Power beat him in the playoff for Barbasol, isn't it, when he won his first win. But he's, you know, he's been a decent ball striker throughout his career, but a phenomenal putter. And I would imagine it's nothing more than a change of scenery, which I do recommend at times. I remember growing up, Pádraig O'Rourke was my kind of mentor in Kilkenny. He was an Irish international, phenomenal, won the South three times, phenomenal putter. And Pádraig had four or five putters in the boot of his car. And some days he'd just look at one and go, yeah, I fancy that one. So at times a change of scenery is good. If you've been historically a very good putter, you're not going to make that big a technical change. Yeah. And, you know, it's just a crazy sport. You roll one in on the first and off you go. And I think for him to win in the fashion that he did, sleeping on the lead, having 31 holes to play on Sunday, if he doesn't win the tournament, he has to Monday qualify for the US Open, which is another 36 the next day. You know, there's a lot on the line. As Dave said, it's his fourth win, but by far the biggest. Mm. And, you know, a huge shot in the arm to him. Like 12 under is a difficult total. You know, it's a very demanding golf course. So it's by far the biggest he's won around the biggest tests with the best field. So he should garner a lot from it. Mm. But you just saw the way he held those putts coming in. He's a very assured putter. He's beautiful. It's kind of like Brad Faxon, really. Would have reminded me of back in the day, who's undoubtedly transformed McIlroy's putting stats. So just rolls the ball beautifully.
Tell me, on the putting, on the changing of the putter, and I'd be like that. I'd a change of scenery, or just, you know, I'd play with a couple of different putters from time to time. That makes a whole heap of sense to me. And yet, when you look at the very best in the game, like, well, I mean, Tiger Woods played that ping answer. Was it ping answer, or did he have, or was it the Scotty?
Yes,
camera?
No, it was a Scotty, but it was a ping answer style.
Sorry, yes. So it's ping answer style, but a Scotty Cameron. You know, he put it with that one like from day one. And you always think that the best putters just stick to, they just find the one thing that works and just stick to it. And maybe psychologically, if you're looking, you go, ooh, if you're changing putters all the time, not all the time, but frequently enough, does that not suggest uncertainty or a lack of full belief in what's going on the greens?
I wouldn't say that at the elite pro level, because, you know, they're putting on carpets week in, week out. But like the loft on your putter is a huge factor.
Right.
And all the modern day putters, we would have grown up with not 5 degrees, but certainly 4 degree putters. And a lot of the new modern putters, there's way less loft on them. So if you're putting on slow greens and you've very little loft on your putter, you're not going to get the ball, you know, rolling like you would. So there's no harm to have it. You're the same putter essentially, but a different model just free you up a little and give you slight change. It would be a slight change. Like I use a spider putter.
So do I.
But I would practice regularly with a blade putter.
Well, is that just to get feel?
A bit of feel. I think at times I struggle with the style of the spider. I get a little bit high back and through. So when you practice with a blade putter, for me, it helps me keep it much low. My dad used to drill it into me low to low, you know. So with the blade putter, that's the way you got to put. But if you look at Crenshaw, even though he had a huge pendulum on him, his putter head was so low through strike, and he was a stunning putter. So. Mm. You know, sometimes a different look can give you a different feel.
Yeah. Rory McIlroy finished 12th alongside Rose and Scheffler. He only hit 30 of 56 fairways during the week. And even he acknowledged that he has work to do with the driver. Here's the thing. Like, next week he's going to need the driver to be on point. You know, at Shinnecock, you can't afford to miss fairways, not that many. obviously winning at Augusta last year, but particularly this year, is one of the defining moments of his career, any golfing career. But do you think it kind of obscured some underlying inconsistency? This is, I mean, Dave, I think you might have said it earlier on. He doesn't have his best stuff. Like, he's not playing as brilliantly as he has done. Like, the last year or so is, you know, he's getting it around and he's doing obviously well enough. But, like...
Yeah, well, look, his last few wins, he hasn't really taken a golf course to its knees. Like, when is the last time he won pulling up,
yeah,
really? All of his wins have been spectacular. Like, you know, he needed a playoff to win the Players. He obviously needed a playoff to beat Rose. He won by one shot this year at Augusta. He needed a playoff to win at the Irish Open. So he's not overpowering the field and he's not overpowering golf courses. He's obviously relying on an awful lot of experience. His short game is probably the most underrated part of his game. His putting has improved massively and his wedge play, as we so often speak about, has improved out of sight over the last 3 to 4 years. His grade A weapon is his driver and that is not functioning properly.
No.
Like, there will be some positives for Rory. Like, he went off like a train on Sunday. He played the first five holes. Mm. First six holes and five under par, and they kind of came to a hold with a bogey on seven, and he never got it going again after that. Not saying he would have got himself into contention, he would have needed a glut of more birdies, but I heard him speaking about his driving issues, and he spoke about them in real, almost David Ledbetter detail, breaking down his golf swing and what the causes were on the backswing and what it was causing to happen on the downswing. It was over my head. I wasn't able to, I'm not educated enough in the golf swing to be able to be proficient in the message that he was trying to give. But it's worrying and it's been ongoing for quite some time now. And if the rough is as deep as it is off the first cut, as he said it was after he paid a visit to Shinnecock the week before last,
yeah.
Well, he's not going to win next week unless he hits more fairways, because he's not able to, no one's going to be able to muscle the ball onto the green like, you know, Bryson did in 2021 when he won his first US Open. So he has to find some sort of a cure to his driving ills over the next week and a half. He has a very good chance he will do that.
Well, I mean, is there? I mean, he hasn't done it yet. Gary, if he's coming into firm, fast greens at Shinnecock next week from the rough, it's going to be harder to hold. So puts a premium, needs to find fairways. Like, he's talked about this. I thought, to Dave's point, I thought he was very interesting talking about his own swing issues, or certainly with the driver and what he sees, what he can notice, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, if the fix was as straightforward as we hope, surely he would have done it by now.
You would say that, and that sounds like common sense, but golf doesn't kind of work like that at times. Mm. If I was in Rory's camp, I'd be trying this week just to get one shape. When you've got a bit of a two-way miss, you need to get one of those out of your game. So if his miss is going to be right, make sure it's just right. I do think at times he's such a field player, I think the camber of the hole at times can determine shape for him. And that can be confusing. But I do think if he can just find one shape this week, because undoubtedly the rhythm that he can forge from his driver will transcend into the rest of his game.
Mm.
You know, if you're a little out of sync with your driver, it can bleed in to your iron play a little bit. And I thought when he found that neutral flight, which he used so brilliantly last year up the 18th and Augusta both times, trying to get back to that, I think it would be an idea. But he so naturally sees a right to left shot. It seems a little contrived for him to hit that little bleeder cut, but if that's a safe option at 180 miles an hour ball speed and you're in play and his iron play, you know, if he's a club back, that's no big deal, but he certainly does have to, because I don't think beating a 3-wood around the US Open does anybody rhythm-wise or timing-wise any favours, so. And you're giving away a massive advantage that he has, but I would certainly hope he's trying to work on, you know, simplifying things this week and just trying to find one shape that he's comfortable with. And then, as always happens in golf, just have the ability to stick to it. That's always the hardest thing. Mm. You know, if you can, and we do it at every level. Doesn't matter what the level is. You're very good all day at doing one shot, and then you say, "Well, I'll just try a little bit of this," and all of a sudden, then it's winged 30 yards right, and you're like, "Why did I do that?" So, to have the patience, kind of like Nelly showed down the stretch, and just keep doing what you're doing. So, I think that's what he'll be looking for this week, because, as Dave was saying, his short game has now become so elite.
Oh, it's so good.
And it's not going to be a gouge around the greens next week, which was great. So the art of chipping and pitching the ball will come to the fore. So hopefully he can straighten out. It's unusual, really, because at the start of the year, I don't know whether it was a bit of a marketing campaign, but I would watch a lot of the TaylorMade YouTube channel, and it's fascinating.
I like it too, by the way.
No, it is. It's brilliant. And, yeah. And I have to say, Nelly Cord is amazing.
Oh, she's great.
Too. And Charlie is great crack on it too. But, you know, you get a great insight into the players and then the technical side of things with the different equipment and what they're doing and stuff. But they were lamenting at the start of the season how good his numbers were with this driver. You know, that he'd never had the consistency of spin rates. And
this is on the TaylorMade YouTube channel, you say.
Well, I know, but, and he's been slashing it all over America for the last while. So I don't think he's ever, listen, if we're worrying about Rory's driving, he's never that far away.
No, at all. No, but
and then, you know,
obviously
and then,
it's margins.
And then the other side of it, consistency is a myth in professional golf.
Okay, it's actually, so that's a very good, it's a great segue to my next point, which is about Scottie Scheffler. So this is less about, like, I don't know if he's anything wrong with his, the mechanics of his golf swing, but clearly he exhibited, or he gave us a glimpse of the incredible pressure that he has, that he now operates under as the number one player in the world, who is expected to show up every week and shoot the lights out and just leave everyone in his dust, puts it in the water and then spends the next minute and a half not berating Ted Scott, but more kind of just expressing his frustrations to his caddy. And I don't think I've ever seen Scheffler be quite so vocal in his frustration before. But one, I guess, Dave, like what you thought of it, but it's says to me is that like he went into the water, like he misjudged the wind a little bit. It feels like golfers underestimate the degree to which luck is an important factor in playing absolutely amazing golf.
Yeah, they do. You know, the wind can change while your ball is in the air.
That's it.
Plenty of hang time off these towering irons these world-class golfers are hitting. And it looks like he got caught a gust. And while he may have hit the exact shot he was planning to hit, he didn't get the outcome that he was planning on. And while they underestimate maybe the impact of luck, I think they also underestimate the amount of microphones that are around golf courses these days.
Yeah.
Everything has been picked up. Stop acting like an asshole.
Do you think,
like,
he,
even if
you
are
acting
one,
like an asshole, do you think?
He's clearly trying to blame his caddy.
Okay.
But he was rabbiting on for about 3 minutes.
Yeah, it was 3 minutes.
And he's saying things like, hang on, you're not listening to me. I don't think you understand just how frustrating that is. Because his caddy was ignoring him. His caddy was like about 5 yards ahead of him, with his back to him, carrying the bag. You know the caddy's thinking, I'm just going to let him have his rant. I'm not going to make eye contact with him. He's the boss. If he wants to go off in one here, that's fine. But like, I'm not going to, you know, acknowledge what he's doing. And that his lack of acknowledgement seemed to stir Scheffler even more so, which is why he said, I don't think you get what I'm saying here. You know, it's, I hit the perfect golf shot and here I am dropping out of a hazard. You hit the golf shot, buddy. You misjudged the wind. Then he hits a shank in a bunker. Was that the caddy's fault?
No, I take everything you're saying. I agree with everything you're saying. But Gary, I said this about Shane, when Shane unloaded on Bo, whatever it was, 2 years ago or thereabouts, is it not also the tense psychology that exists in the golfer's mind that the caddy-player relationship is such for a lot of teams whereby the caddy understands that, like, he needs that frustration out of his body in order to go on to play golf. Now, the shank, except leave that to one side.
Yeah.
So that Ted Scott understands that, look, Scotty in his conscious mind isn't blaming me for it, but I need to just absorb all of his frustrations, because otherwise that frustration will kind of churn on him and he won't be able to get back to playing the good golf that he plays. And I said that about Shane and Bo.
Yeah, and the other side, the caddy won't have the clarity to make the decisions that he needs to make either. So it's a two-way street as well. It is. It's probably a rant, and, you know, a lot of experienced caddies would never really hear it. But if it's an ongoing thing where it's affecting, I guess, you know, how if you know, you have a situation where there's a short flag over water and Ted Scott's been getting it in the side of the head for 2.5 hours, he's probably going to give him a half a club too much to make sure he does cover the water. And that's where relationships break down. Now, Scotty Scheffler was notoriously difficult on his previous caddies.
Yeah.
And when Ted Scott came on the bag, he did seem to transform him, because obviously there would have been a ferocious amount of respect for Ted Scott from Scheffler. And you'll always have that initial thing. You know, this guy is a bit of an icon of what he does. I'm not going to get into him like I normally do. Now, maybe it's reached a crescendo where he's at Everest and it's a little bit scary looking down rather than trying to look up to get there. Maybe Scheffler has come to that point in his career, and greatness is determined really how you adapt to that. Now, if he's adapting by giving Ted a load of stuff, and if that continues on, Ted might have a quick look on a Friday evening at the ATM machine and go, I don't need this. So I'm not suggesting that's what's at play here, but Scheffler was very, very difficult on his caddies. And
is it not also the case that when Ted Scott and Scotty Scheffler started working together, that Ted Scott laid down the law to Scheffler and he said, look, these are the conditions under which I'll come and work. I'm not going to tolerate this. I won't tolerate that. Like this kind of behavior.
Yeah.
Like Ted Scott's no dummy. And I think Scheffler was very, very happy. Like, I mean, Dave, I don't disagree with anything you're saying. Like the behavior, like in outside of that context is like unreasonable at best. But at the same time, given the pressure cooker situations that these guys find themselves in, that perhaps this is just the cost of doing business. Ted Scott knows this. Ted Scott is like, okay, fine. And then after the round is over, they'll have, you know, a drink and a chat and it'll all be good.
Maybe.
I'm not saying that Ted Scott's going to walk away.
I mean, why would he?
He's probably the best bag in the game at the moment. But there's still no need to really for him to speak to him like that. He's a big boy. He's been around the block more than enough times. I'd say he had forgotten about it by the time they got to the drop zone.
Yeah.
Okay, this is not like a cry for help from me for Ted Scott. But I'm just saying that he hasn't exactly covered himself in glory in terms of some of the interaction he's had with the media in recent weeks. Obviously, what happened there that we're just discussing, he's had some really short, snappy riposte to sometimes fairly innocuous questions. And I just wonder, is it all building up to Shinnecock? Because like next year, outside of his first ever major, next week is the biggest major of his career.
That's it.
It's the first crack at the Grand Slam. And just like McIlroy, he's kind of scrabbling around looking for his best game as well. And the window's closing because he's going to wake up Monday morning and he's going to have to get himself to Shinnecock Hills. And it is US Open week. And all the focus is going to be on him as the next man off the rank who is contesting a career Grand Slam and looking to join that most elite of lists. And I wonder, maybe, is that playing into it as well? Look, he came very close to winning at Augusta. I mean, one or two rolls of a ball, golf ball, and he may well have won at Augusta. Was never really close in the PGA Championship. But it's all on next week. And maybe that's playing in as well. And he's been a bit of a perfectionist as well, I'm sure. If he didn't get to where he did not having those sorts of standards.
Play devil's advocate. Does it not make him a slightly more interesting character? Everyone accuses him of being just so dull. All of a sudden, Scotty Scheffler.
Oh, no, 100%. I mean, go off on your caddy every week.
Yeah, totally.
A man who is certainly not averse to going off is Tyrrell Hatton. Dave, you can you can just put your feet up and have a listen here for the next couple of minutes. As Gary and I, look, I'm going to say, look, last week I came out with some bold statements saying that Ben Griffin looked great to me for Memorial, and as I said, ended up missing the cut. So what do I know? But Tyrrell Hatton wins at tough golf courses. He's won at Wentworth, Bay Hill, St. Andrews, and now he's won Live Andalusia at Valderrama, which is maybe the toughest golf course in Europe. And he won well. Like, this is quality playing. He's just clearly, like, in great touch. And so this augurs well for him going into Shinnecock.
Oh, it does. There's no denying. I mean, he ran so close last year.
Yeah.
Was it Oakmont last year? Yeah, and he's got the game. He's got the short game. He's got a bit of a baby boom as well going on. Sometimes that can really affect a player. I'm not saying he's going to turn into Cinderella on the golf course, but you know, the manner in which he won, like, Ram is in the game in front. They're in Spain. It seemed, you wouldn't know nowadays with AI, but it seemed that there was quite a big crowd there, and Garcia is in the final group with Hatton. So it's actually your dream combination to win a golf tournament down in Spain against two of Spain's greatest ever players.
Yeah,
you literally couldn't wish for any more. And then Ram was doing his usual, you know, charging his way home, you know, like McIlroy and Scheffler and Woods have done in the past when they haven't won tournaments. They've eked every single thing out of their round. So, as great champions do.
Mm.
Like, his bunker shot on 17 was unbelievable.
Ugh.
His shot out of the trees. I know Dave can talk us through it, but he shot out of the trees on 18. And John Rahm's shot on 18. You know, that old art of drilling a low 4 or 5 iron through a gap and cutting it around the corner.
You don't
see that stuff nowadays.
Were you good finding those gaps?
I was very fortunate in that when I went to college in America, we had the driving range that we were practice ground or wherever that we practiced at, there was woods either side. And maybe once every 3 weeks or so, the coach used to bring us into the trees and we had to hit shots out and have a competition. And that's where I learned I would say a flair for those shots.
Mm.
But it's a practice flair. So it's something every kid should do. And you can do it on the range too. And I will give away a trade secret, a wonderful thing to do. If you have any kids getting into golf and you're a decent enough wedge player, you can do a thing called, it's like a clay pigeon shoot. So you get your child and it'll teach them how to hit an iron as well. Get them to get a 6 or 7 iron. And you get your sand wedge and you're obviously side by side, but it's just the art of manufacturing shots. So you hit a wedge maybe 40, 50 yards in front of you, but literally try hit it as high as you possibly can. So as the ball is coming down, the other person is there with their 6 or 7 iron trying to hit the ball on the way down.
I've watched this. The algorithm has served this up to me where the Japanese dude out in some range in Japan just keeps trying to hit his own shots. He's just hitting one up and then hitting a low one. To try and
no, but if you get two people doing it, and I literally reckon my son and I, we probably might spend my lifetime trying to do it, but I can't wait for the day that actually one ball makes contact with the other.
But, amazing.
And coach got us to do that in the States. You get into the trees and just hit shots out. But
that's class.
The shots that Hatton and Ram hit up 18 were
sensational. So, look, lads, we're going to have to leave it there. Obviously, next week, we're going to have a big preview pod for Shinnecock. We're all looking forward to it. I think Ram and Hatton, again, of the Live players, they're looking great. Hatton particularly just looks so good. So it's been a brilliant week for Nelly. Very, very good week for Charlie Hull. Maybe she'll be disappointed, but I think it was. Obviously, JD Poston. Well done, lads. Gary, as always, Dave, thank you both very much. Nathan will be with you with the Ryan Line on Thursday. So you can put your questions into the Discord channel or you can email off golfweekly@offtheball.com. And Brona, our long suffering producer, will take care of that. Cheers, lads.
Thanks, guys.
starter kit right here.